From ESPN Films and ESPN Audio, you're listening to 30 for 30 Podcasts. The quest to conquer the Arctic has enticed and evaded explorers for centuries. Thousands of people have died trying to make the trip, by ship, by foot, by dog sled, and even once by balloon. But in 1997, a woman named Caroline Hamilton decided to make history by taking a team made up entirely of amateur women to the North Pole. 30 for 30's Rose Eveleth takes us on the ice.
The first attempt on the North Pole by a team of women gets underway today. Four of them set off from Resolute Bay in northern Canada on the first stage of the 1,000-kilometre trek to the pole. There are five teams working out.
March 14th, 1997. Day one.
As these women just proudly walked over to the Twin Otter, you know, the mist rising from our breaths and the early dawn light capturing it. It felt like we were astronauts heading off to our spaceship. It was so exciting.
The heart's going. The heart definitely is going.
You just get in the plane and it's magical. I love Twin Otters. The sound and the smell of the av gas.
The plane is amazing.
Twin Otters are wonderful things. I mean, just the propellers.
It's like the biggest hairdryer in the world.
And the snow starts churning up behind and you're jam-packed in. He's against your pulks, your sledges, which are all jammed into this little plane as well.
And then you kind of go out and you're flying away from civilization and over, you know, over the Arctic.
I think that's when it really hit me that we were on ice, and you saw the big thick black lines that were the leads that had opened up. And as we were flying over, I think it really hit me, and I probably went very quiet for quite some time as it dawned on me exactly what we were trying to do.
On March 14th, 1997, a group of British ladies set out to be the first all-women's team to reach the North Pole. These women weren't experienced adventurers. They were ordinary women, complete amateurs. Some of them didn't even realize that the top of our planet was made of ice, not land, until they set out to reach it. And they set out to reach it because of an ad in a newspaper.
I was on the tube going to work, and I saw an advert saying women wanted to walk to the North Pole.
August 1995, London. The classified ads of the Daily Telegraph.
Applications are invited from women of any age, background, and occupation, but they will have to prove fitness and commitment. They will have to put up with real pain and discomfort. They will wonder every 10 steps what they are doing, but they have an opportunity to take part in an epic adventure.
The epic adventure will take them over 1,000 kilometres of hazardous sea ice. They'll be travelling in relays and hauling supplies and equipment in temperatures which can drop as low as minus 45 degrees.
Five teams of four will undertake two-week relays in an attempt to cover the 1,000-kilometre journey, enabling women who've had no previous expedition experience to take part.
Nearly 200 amateurs applied for the trip. Women like Ann Daniels.
When I first heard about the relay, I was actually in my dining room and I was rolling a ball to my 18-month-old triplets.
In 1995, Ann Daniels was a former bank clerk. Former because when she had triplets, she had to leave her job.
I would literally sit in a chair with two pillows and put a child to each breast and then a pillow on my knee and feed the third child, rather like a milking machine.
Anne could barely keep up with the three tiny babies that needed her attention. Her marriage was on the rocks, and making it through every day was a challenge. Going to the North Pole seemed totally impossible.
My first thought was, it's not for people like me, you know, mothers of children who have never done anything outdoors, have never had walking boots on my feet. I mean, I've been on holiday to Spain and lied by the pool, but it was package holidays. I had never been outside or done anything in any remote region.
But then again,
it was something different that I could do that wasn't all-consuming and children.
So she applied. January 1996, Dartmoor, England. Tryouts. Round one. Every woman who applied for the trip to the North Pole got a letter in return telling them to show up to a damp, foggy park called Dartmoor. They weren't told what to expect, but they did know that this was an audition. Only 20 of them could be on the team. That weekend, it rained. A cold, hard January rain, sometimes coming down sideways. But the women showed up anyway. 60 of them.
I'm Rosie Stancer.
Lucy Martin.
Paula Power.
I'm Emma Goulden, formerly Emma Scott.
I'm Sue Fully Love.
I was taking a gap year between A-levels and university.
I was a junior doctor.
I was working as a financial journalist on the Independent newspaper.
I worked in software development.
There was also a police officer, a flight attendant, teachers, stay-at-home moms. And when they arrived at Dartmoor, they were greeted by a woman named Caroline Hamilton. This trip was her idea, an idea she had hatched on a whim.
A friend of mine was dating a polar explorer, and I met him, and he inspired me. He talked about it and didn't make it sound too difficult, and I thought, well, if he can do it, so can I.
That friend was a guy named Penn Haddo.
I can remember her roaring off in, I think, leathers on a motorbike, which I thought was different.
Caroline wanted to go to the North Pole, and Penn wanted to help her. But they knew that Caroline couldn't do it alone. They would need a team, and they would need money.
And then I thought, well, yes, well, this is going to be fabulously expensive. And I can remember the costs were £325,000, which would be very roughly $500,000, I suppose, very roughly.
To get money, they would need sponsors. And to get sponsors, they would need something eye-catching. Something that the media would grab onto. Something like the first all-women's trip to the North Pole.
That would be interesting to the public and the media.
And it was. Women from all over the UK showed up on Dartmoor, excited to join the exclusive world of polar exploration.
That weekend, I was completely annihilated. I didn't know what I was doing. After an hour, I felt like this rucksack was ripping my shoulders off. Everybody could see I was just a bit of a wreck. At night, I literally sobbed when nobody could see me.
By the end of a full day of hiking through mud and rain and fog, Anne didn't just feel miserable. She also felt alone in her misery.
My vivid memory is these women going up the roads, singing and laughing, and I just wanted to cry. I was in tatters. I couldn't believe the different, just how horrific I felt, and that anybody could have had an ounce of energy, not let alone laugh.
Sue and Victoria were two of those women, walking down the road, singing and laughing.
I'm Sue Riches.
I'm Victoria Humphreys.
Victoria, there's lots of argument here, rang me up and said she was going to go on this expedition. And somehow I found myself joining her. I say she asked me, she said she didn't.
She claims I invited her. My defence is that what 24, 25-year-old would invite their mother on an expedition with them?
They may have been in better shape than Anne, but they weren't any better prepared for a trip to the North Pole.
It was somewhere that I didn't know anything about. I didn't read any books to really scare myself. It was all slightly surreal.
See, I thought it felt quite real to me. But maybe because I'd read all these books and
see,
I realised they were real stories.
No, I hadn't. I thought I didn't want to scare myself too much. But I'd just had breast cancer. I'd had a mastectomy 6 months before. But also, and Victoria will say this is my optimism, I knew I'd get better. You know, I really genuinely woke up the next morning after the op and I knew I would be better. So sorry, Victoria, more optimism.
This is eternal optimism, drives me demented.
Penn was right that an expedition full of ordinary women would attract the media. They showed up on Dartmoor that weekend too. They simply couldn't resist the sight of 60 ordinary British ladies tromping around a moor, acting like they were really, truly going to go to the North Pole. They loved that Sue and Victoria were mother-daughter,
But their perfect interview subject was Anne Daniels, a petite blonde woman with a great smile and easy laugh. And, most appealing of all, she was a mother of three very young babies.
What makes her achievement all the more extraordinary is that she set off leaving her young triplets at home.
Anne Daniel from Bradford has triplets aged 2.5.
A mother of triplets.
Mother of triplets.
And a mother of triplets are involved.
I was interviewed a lot, mother of triplets, what will it be like?
And in the middle of one of those interviews, Anne Daniels realized that this wasn't just a fun weekend away from the kids. This was something that she wanted.
And that was when I caught the dream, because I just kept saying what I'd been told. It's a chance of a lifetime. It's a, you know, imagine somebody like me. And I just thought, oh, hang on. Wow. What if I could do this?
September 1996. Tryout number 2. Dartmoor again. Anne again. But this time, different. Anne had spent the last 9 months training.
Over that period of time, it became about being a mother, training, being a mother, training. And that was the only thing that really occupied me for that time. I was so focused.
This time, she was ready.
I know that I was bad, and I know they were surprised when I turned up again, that I was a different human being the second time.
This time, it was hard for everybody. At one point, the organizers shook the women awake in the middle of the night and lined them up on the moor. Out in the blackness somewhere was a Land Rover, they said. Run to it and back.
And I could hear them saying things like, you must pace yourself, you must do this, you must do that. And there were marathon runners amongst them, and I thought, I'm not pacing myself, I'm just going to run until I fall over. And I set off like a bullet, and I just ran and ran and ran and ran. And there were times when I did think, before I got to the Land Rover, I've really messed up. And I just thought, you have to keep it up. You have to just keep running and running and running. And I didn't know if I was going to get to the end, but I did. And that was a huge euphoric moment to pass first out of everybody. I felt like I'd got to the North Pole.
The first all-women's attempt at the North Pole was, mercifully, a relay. The 20 women had been selected. 5 teams of 4 women each would push as far and as fast as they could. Each team would be on the ice for about 3 weeks before handing the baton, which in this case was a stuffed penguin, to the next group of 4. February 28th, 1997. Yeovil, England, Anne's house. Anne was on the first leg of the relay, the first team to set out for the Arctic. And it was now time to travel north, to leave her triplets with her mother, and head out into one of the most treacherous regions of the world.
I said goodbye to them at home, and it was really difficult because they were only 3 years of age, and I'd never been without them, and I'd been with them for such a long time. And it was heart-wrenching. And my mother had sort of spoke to them and said, oh, you must be really brave and smile, because you don't want your mum's last memory of you to be in tears. And so when we all said goodbye, we were really happy and, oh, you know, it won't be long and I'll be in touch and it'll be very exciting. And I left smiling. And literally, as I drove away from the house, I just burst into tears because it was awful to leave them behind.
March 1st, 1997. Resolute, Canada. To get to the North Pole, you first have to get to Resolute, a tiny community in the far northernmost reaches of Canada. At Resolute, the women met their guides. Their lead guide was a 45-year-old American woman named Maddie McNair, who owned an outdoor adventure travel company with her husband, Paul.
My husband at the time, Paul Landry, was in the UK and ran into Penhaddo, and they had too many beers, I think. And when Penn started talking about, oh, I have a client who wants to put a women's expedition together to go to the North Pole, Paul said, oh, the only person that could get your group safely there is my wife. And so he came back all excited about, whoa, you know, I think I saw this, you know, this trip that you're going to, that maybe you're guiding to the North Pole. And he was all excited about it. And I was going, and why do I want to do this?
Maddie had then recruited a second guide, a Canadian named Denise Martin, a woman who lived up in the Yukon, a woman who Maddie had been a mentor to for years.
And in her Maddie way, just phoned up, hi, Denise, how you doing? Oh, I'm fine, Maddie. What's going on? Well, do you want to go to the North Pole? And I just said, sure, why not?
Maddie and Denise were two of the most experienced Arctic guides in the world. But neither of them had ever been to the North Pole. Very few women had. And no all-women's team had ever made the trip. At Resolute, the women also met their final trainer, a man named Jeff Summers. It was his job to make sure that these amateur women had the skills they needed to stay alive.
I'd spent a lifetime up till then of doing polar trips, and it still scared me. So for them, it was a colossal challenge. During their training, I had each group for 10 to 15 days. I kept a diary, just a daily journal of the training, and I often talk about what am I doing sending these people out. But the first day, dropping that first group off, I thought, my goodness, what have I done?
March 14th, 1997, day one. The plane has dropped them off on the ice.
You feel very alone when that plane takes off. You feel really, really alone.
They've gone. There's no civilization. It's us. Thousands of miles of ice and nobody.
It was like your umbilical cord stretching out, stretching, stretching out. Snap. Gone. And when you see the twin otter just to give a little tilt of its wings and away it goes, and you feel that that's really your last point of contact. And then just nothing.
I had a bit of a sense of shock. It's actually not this nice, white, flat, snow-covered, lovely skiing surface that I hoped for. It was a lot of open water. It was full of, like, these mountains of ice, and it all looked incredibly impossible. I mean, I just remember thinking, there's no way in the world we're going to get through that stuff.
And the ice is, it's everything. It's sharp, jagged, harsh lines. It's soft, beautiful, undulating snow. It's crystals where the sun glints on the crystals of the ice and it reflects in different colours. So you see the pastels, the pinks and the blues. And the ice itself, it can be frosted white or aquamarine clear blue.
Aquamarine blue, and you get this electric blue shining out of the lumps of ice, and it looks as a torch inside shining.
I was just to think it looked like there was a little goblin in there holding up a lantern. But the first time that it moves properly, when you're stood there and these ridges as high as mountains suddenly start to move in front of your eyes, the noise then is astronomical. It is like a train coming. What I would say is it can be viciously serene, so it looks all beautiful and twinkly and sparkly, and it can turn stormy and nasty and life-threateningly dangerous.
To the North Pole, each leg of the relay had to walk or ski, usually both, over miles and miles of ice. They carried their supplies in big sleds, or pulks as the British call them, like little boats with red bottoms scraping along the ice.
The pulks that we had had a kind of green, light green strip around them, but I became obsessed with I wanted an apple, a fresh, green, crunchy apple.
The pulks are supposed to float if they fall into the water, but they can sink, and you're tied to them.
Sue. She had a great name for it. She called it frozen bondage. She'd have to put on her frozen bondage every day.
March 26th, 1997. For the last few days, the women have zigzagged back and forth to avoid a deep river of open water, something called a lead. But this morning, the thick, black lead that had stopped them the day before had just barely frozen over, a thin skin of sparkling ice. And the women of that first team, Claire Fletcher, Sue Foleylove, Jan McCormick, and Anne Daniels, set off.
I decided that it was okay to travel kind of along the edge because if somebody went through, we could jump up on this jumbled up ice and it would be a good place to rescue somebody from.
We were skating along and I'm behind Claire and I could feel myself getting frightened. The ice is undulating, so it's bouncing, and Claire was in front of me and her foot broke through the ice and I knew I was going to go in. So I just tried to ski as fast as I could, but I felt my skis go in. And as my skis went in and I went down, it was very fast, but it felt like it was slow motion and I just felt sick.
Anne was in the water at the bend in the icy path. The women in front of her couldn't see her. The women behind her could only see her stopped sledge, not her scrambling body around the corner.
So at first I started to shout for help, and then I realized nobody could hear me.
She was too far back and out of sight to even communicate.
And I thought, I have to get out.
To her left, the hard ice rose up out of the water.
And I grabbed high, there was a boulder of rock, and hauled myself up. And as I was hauling myself up, the rock of ice broke off and I plunged back in. And I thought, okay, try again. And I tried a second time and the same thing happened again. And then I was starting to get really frightened and thought, I just have to keep trying. And if this doesn't work, then I have to do something else. Because if I don't try, I am going to die.
And in the back of Anne's mind, she could hear Maddie, her guide.
My favorite saying is, if you get wet, you die.
So the third time, it did work, and I managed to sit on a ledge.
Anne was out of the water, but she was still wet, and she had to get dry as fast as she could before the water on her suit froze.
And Maddie said, what you need to do now is roll in the snow and get the moisture out of you. It's a good absorbent.
The Arctic is an icy desert, and the snow up there is very, very dry. Dry enough that when it hits water, it sucks it right up.
Somebody took my boot off while someone else got my spare socks. I put my foot up Jan's jumper while they took my wet socks off and replaced and put dry socks and boots on.
As they warmed Anne's feet against their bare skin and helped her change her socks, a seal popped its head up and out of the water.
I look over and there's a seal.
A little wet bowling ball head, beady eyes.
And the seal has a little head out of the water. It's a ring seal. And it's swimming along looking at me. It was so much fun.
And then the seal was gone, slipped down into the black water. And the team started to walk, strapped back into their sledges to get moving, to get Anne warmed up again. Maddie was glad to be moving, not just for Anne's sake. Seals are a favorite polar bear food.
We were in temperatures of minus 32 and then wind chill on top of that. So all the time you're in pain with your fingers and your toes being cold. You're pulling a heavy sledge and you're exhausted. And sometimes it just feels like you want to stop and sit down and give in, but you can't. So in order for me to keep going, when I was really tired and my legs wanted to stop, was to just chant the children. And I would literally chant the children. Lucy, Joseph, Rachel. Lucy, Joseph, Rachel. And just keep at it and see their faces. Lucy, Joseph, Rachel. Lucy, Joseph, Rachel.
March 30th, 1987. The first leg of the relay has hauled their bodies and sledges 56 nautical miles over 17 days. It was now time for the next team of women to take the stuffed penguin baton and continue north. But Anne didn't want to leave.
We left and I looked at the ice and I had a real yearning and a real goodbye moment and a real, I don't know if I'll ever come back here again. And I looked at the ice and I felt quite an affinity, like a proper, I'm leaving you now, like a relationship.
What she didn't know on that plane was that while she was on the ice, her marriage went from failing to finished.
They brought letters from the family out. And I was the only one that didn't get a letter. So I was quite sad, is quite honest. I was really sad. I was on the plane, nobody had these letters and I didn't. And particularly I knew, I didn't get a letter from my husband, I knew that was it, that we'd finished, and that was quite difficult. I didn't want the marriage to end, I was very heartbroken.
Her babies were there, waiting for her. But the rest of her life was gone. Like the ice, it had given out from underneath her.
So it became quite physical, and then when they went to bed, then I'd allow myself to cry. And, I don't know how I'm going to do this. And then the blackness would, I don't know how I'm going to get up tomorrow. Then you get up tomorrow, and the children refocus you, and you keep going. And then you get to sleep again at night. And I'd got three small children that I had to look after on my own. I didn't have the money, the resources, there was all that. And so I had a new challenge to focus on.
April 12th, 1997. Another team on, another team off. The second team marched 75 more miles. Now it was Team Charlie's turn. Paula Power, Lynn Clark, and the mother-daughter duo, Sue and Victoria Riches. Here is how Maddie describes Sue and Victoria in her personal logbook. Sue, 51, is a tall, elegant woman. She takes the ice and snow obstacles in stride, even though this is her first outdoor adventure. Victoria is 26, that age at which everything is possible if you want it badly enough. She is a tall woman, like her mother, and has an invincible attitude.
They were really good at supporting each other when they needed support.
April 20th, 1997. A storm blew in.
Okay, we're standing on top of the hill, the tent. We stand there. It's now Sunday morning. And the wind, according to this, is gusting, 30 miles an hour just then. It's been going up to 40 plus all day, all night.
A storm bad enough that they had to stay inside all day, which was nice at first. A day to sleep in, a day to rest and repair skis, play games, cook.
For lunch. While we wait for the storm to brew over.
When you can smell it.
Of making chocolate shortbread. And here Victoria's melting the chocolate and butter over
and
the billy can. And the dried milk powder. And in the background you can hear Denise hammering the shortbread into crumbs. It's going to be added to the chocolate mix and put outside to set, and apparently it's a scrumptious recipe.
But in the Arctic, there is danger in everything, including resting. As they sat, they drifted. Overnight, the team slid nearly 20 miles east. April 21st, 1997. The next morning, Maddie poked her head out of the tent and decided that conditions were good enough to pack up and go. The women were antsy. Morale was low. It was gray and windy, windier than usual. Sue and Victoria could barely see their feet.
So we came to this area of mist.
I think we called it the hell zone. The winds are blowing. You can hear the ice cracking and groaning underneath you.
And we started to cross when suddenly the ice started disintegrating underneath my feet.
Sue, ski fast, you're sinking.
I was aware of Matty's go, go, go.
They started shouting, Sue, Sue, move fast.
But why? You know, what was she shouting this go, go, go for?
And she stopped and looked down, and sure enough, her heels went through, and she just slid right in.
And so I found myself walking into this water, and then sinking up to my neck.
Mum just disappeared.
I was kicking like mad, and so one boot and ski came off.
And I thought, oh God, she's going to die. She survived cancer. She's going to die now.
Victoria reached out to try and save her mother, but the ice was disappearing all around them, and she fell in too.
All I remember was thinking, we've got to get out of here. We've just got to get out of here because we will die. My fear is of my sledge pulls me down under the water, pulls me down, and then the ice closes up above me, and so I can't get back out.
Then the third domino fell. Denise, their guide, broke through the ice as well.
She's crawling and pulling herself up and dragging her skis, and then she'd kind of get back up on her feet and go through again. And, you know, my heart just kept sinking when she sank and coming up when she was up. It was like this nightmare to watch her.
And the one thought that went into my head as the water, I could feel it on my earlobes. What would a dog do in this situation? You know, a dog would dog paddle, you know, and keep their head up. So I ended up swimming with my skis on quite a distance.
I remember Mum swearing, and Mum doesn't particularly swear, but she was saying shit, 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 shit. That was when I kind of woke up. Oh my God, what's happened? Help, help, help.
Two women with no experience and one of their guides that is supposed to be able to save them are all in the water. And the river is getting wider and wider. After several frantic minutes, Sue and Victoria drifted over to Maddie, who helped haul them out. Denise finished swimming to the other side to join up with the other two relay members, Paula and Lynn.
Maddie, I gotta get my book. Denise, gotta get these guys off of here. What's your plan? Anything? Is it moving towards you?
I'm stable.
Not great. I'm gonna go try and get it though.
You want me to? I'm a bit lighter.
No. I don't want you to go in the water. We can't get another person in the water.
Okay.
Denise is. I can tell she's getting hypothermic just from the tone of her voice, and she's lost both skis and both boots now, and so she's standing there. She's dripping wet, and she's kind of freaking out, and she's just screaming at me, Maddie, my fucking feet are freezing! Maddie! And the wind's picking up, so it's starting to be harder and harder to yell across.
Hold on to that, are we?
The river between the two groups was too wide to cross. But standing there would mean certain death for Sue and Victoria, who would soon become human icicles. So they started walking.
And it just walked on and on and on.
Maddie imagined the two groups, wandering out on the sea ice, the winds blowing their tracks away behind them.
The worst thing that could happen is not us going through the ice, but being separated and not being able to find each other. And the weather was starting to shut down. Visibility was getting poor.
Sue had lost a boot, so she was walking with a stuff sack on one of her feet.
And we just had to keep on jumping over little island. And each time you just thought, how are we going to get out of this? And then we got to this junction, this Y of the riverbank, where our bank kind of forked one way, their bank forked the other, and there was no way we would get over to the other side. At that point, it was almost despair. What do we do? But we then had this bizarre moment where the ice just came over to us.
The great big pans of ice started to come back together, closing this lead.
And it wasn't like the whole river. It was just this one little bit of ice in front of us.
I strongly, strongly, strongly believe it was a miracle of some description. Something happened. Something saved our lives. We're very, very lucky.
April 22nd, 1997. The river that just the day before had nearly swallowed them was now frozen. And sticking out of it were a variety of supplies that had been lost the day before. now frozen into the ice like popsicle sticks. Maddie slid out onto the ice with an axe and chopped their gear out. Then it was time to get going.
I was quite jumpy because I thought to myself, when we met open water, I've fallen in once and survived. If I fall in a second time, can I survive?
The next day, I was absolutely convinced that it would happen again and we would get wet again and we wouldn't all be so lucky the next time. I can't describe the fear that I was feeling. I cannot describe how terrified I was, absolutely terrified, every second of that day. I honestly thought I was going to die in the Arctic.
Sue later wrote in her diary that falling in the water was the worst day of her life, worse than finding out she had cancer. Cancer is something you can't see. But in the Arctic, she wrote, the reality is right there in front of you, and there is no escape. April 28th, 1997. Sue and Victoria, like all the women before them, got their escape. They climbed into the tiny plane and headed back to Resolute Bay. The next team took the baton, and Maddie and Denise led them north. May 17th, 1997. The final relay team hits the ice. Lucy Martin, Palm Oliver, Zoe Hudson, and Caroline Hamilton, the organizer of this whole wild adventure. 110 miles left to go, striking distance.
Almost there. The last of the five teams of four women are in pole position. They're just hours away from their target of reaching the top of the world.
This is the real meaning of girl power, and it's taking them to the top of the world. Five teams have trekked 600 miles in relay. When the final group arrives at the North Pole, it'll be the first all-woman expedition to complete this epic journey.
May 26th, 1997. Pole Day. On this day, the first all-women's relay reached the North Pole.
And it was a bit kind of like, oh, my God, we're here. It's a beautiful sunny day, and I can't believe we can actually stop. It felt like we should have felt exhausted and sort of like ready to throw ourselves on the ground through fatigue and hunger. But it was like, oh, I guess we just set up camp now. We kind of don't really know what to do.
Yeah, what do you do when you get to the North Pole? So we decided we must sing the national anthem.
Half past one on the morning of May 27th, we arrived here at the North Pole at 10:45 last night. Just a few hours ago, not been to bed yet, obviously, lots of celebration.
It's really, you have to play your head around, like I'm at the top of, you have to imagine I'm standing on the very tip of our planet.
I'm in the same time zone as London. And if I keep walking in this way around the circle, I'm going to walk through all the time zones of the world. 1 o'clock. 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. I reckon I'm in Moscow now.
And if I run around the North Pole counterclockwise, will I get younger? Or if I stand over here, it's tomorrow. And if I go over here, it's yesterday? No, wait a minute.
They'd walked hundreds of miles over shifting ice. All that remained was to trek across the arrivals lounge at Heathrow. There, a warm welcome for women who'd conquered the coldest place on Earth.
This morning at Heathrow, they were reunited with friends and other team members.
This was the last of the five teams who'd endured temperatures of minus 45 degrees Celsius and risked attack from polar bears to reach the North Pole.
The 1997 Women's Relay was a success. It was the first all-women's team to walk to the North Pole. Maddie and Denise had brought 20 amateur women on one of the toughest trips in the world. What do you do when you get back from the North Pole? For some, their brush with the icy North nudged them onto a different path.
It was probably the only time in my life when I haven't had a big to-do list or I've got a weight on my shoulders of something that needs to be done. The only time in my life when I've had no real pressures is those few weeks up in the Arctic.
When she got off the ice, Victoria left her job
I wanted to leave London.
And her boyfriend.
I'd realised while up in the pole that it wasn't the man I wanted to marry, it wasn't the man I wanted to be with.
When Anne got back from the ice, she had no choice over whether she wanted to be on a different path. Her husband had left her. He had decided that for her.
I knew I didn't want to be with him. I just had been with that man since I was 18, so I didn't quite know how to fill that gap. You know, he was everything to me, and suddenly I'm a really single mother of triplets, and I've got a broken heart, and I don't know what to do with myself, and for quite a while I struggled. And I'd look after the children during the day, and when I put them to bed, more often than not, I'd be very upset.
For a lot of the women, the expedition was like a dream, or a trip to another planet. When they got home, they just settled back into their lives. These days, almost all of the women have moved on from polar life. They run record labels and software companies. They're teachers, designers, doctors. Maddie is retired and goes dog sledding as much as she can. Denise works at a school in Scotland as an outdoor instructor. Today, even if the women wanted to replicate their entire 416-mile North Pole relay, it would be nearly impossible. Not because they're 20 years older, but because the ice is melting too fast.
There are very, very few people now that can manage to go all the way. It is so much more difficult with much, much more open water. The pole has less and less ice each year.
And there just is so much water now. Anecdotally and absolutely too much.
And Anne knows, because after that first trip to the North Pole, Anne Daniels found a new passion and a new job.
I'm Anne Daniels, and before this trip, I was very lucky to be a mother of triplets and ex-bank clerk. And now I am a polar guide and mother of four children.
Today, Anne Daniels is one of the most experienced polar guides in the world.
So I'm going in April.
Yeah, I'm training. I've pulled a few injuries. I must be getting old.
April this year, it's a climate change expedition. It is specifically to raise awareness of what's happening up there.
And on April 18th, 2017, just over a month before the 20th anniversary of the 1997 All-Women's Relay success, Anne Daniels was at the North Pole once again.
It's Anne Daniels here at the very top of the world, the North Geographic Pole.
We made it.
And we got to the top of the world. 20 years ago when I started, a lot of it was the same cold hands, the same cold feet. The journey is always different. The ice changes, it moves, it melts, it grows again. So every year is a different journey. The difference now, of course, is I am now at the front. I'm navigating, I'm making sure people have what they need and passing on the knowledge that I've gained over 20 years. But now it's time to leave and come home again.
Thanks for listening to 30 for 30 Podcasts. My name is Jody Avergan. This episode was produced and reported by Rose Eveleth. Our producers are Andrew Mambo and Julia Lowry Henderson. Taylor Barfield and Kate McAuliffe are our production assistants. Mixing, sound design, and original music for this episode by Ryan Ross Smith. Connor Schell and Libby Geist are executive producers for ESPN Films. Aaron Lydon is senior producer, and Adam Newhouse is director of development. The ESPN Films team includes Deirdre Fenton, Jenna Anthony, Ryan Nantel, Catherine Sankey, Jennifer Thorpe, and Colin Fleming. The ESPN audio team includes Trog Keller, Tom Ricks, Megan Judge, Pete Giannacini, and Ryan Graner. Special thanks to Ryan Hurley, Ray Dinahan, Rodney Belazaire, and RJ Santillo at ESPN New York. Chi-Young Park did archival research, and Roger Jackson provided fact-checking for this episode. We got production help from Kaz Graham, Dasha Lysitsina, Jason Titley, Andy Ingelmels, and Fiona Clampin. Special thanks to Emily Condon, and to Ann Daniels, Sue Riches, and Victoria Humphreys for their archival footage from the ice. Special thanks to Penn Hatto and Joe Sykes. Our theme music was composed by Rishikesh Hirway of the podcast Song Exploder. We're posting lots of extras on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you want to see a picture of the women on the ice, give us a follow. And you can sign up for our newsletter through our website, 30for30podcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to 30 for 30 Podcasts in the ESPN app or Apple Podcasts. We'll be back next week with more 30 for 30.